Perry Mills, we're standing in the classroom that tradition tells us was the schoolroom in which Shakespeare learned his Latin and his Greek and maybe learned the rudiments even of becoming a playwright. Last November, you and I persuaded 14 boys in this school to join us in a collaboration on a project to learn and rehearse and perform a very little known early modern play, John Marston's The Dutch Courtesan. And I want to revisit that project. I want you to tell us about that. But I want to go back and set the scene, to contextualize how it was that we got to where we got with the boys and the Dutch Courtesan by thinking what we had done a couple of years earlier. Could you just remind me of that history?
Yeah. I mean, time flies, but it's about 4 or 5 years. Michael Wood came in to produce a BBC television series about In Search of Shakespeare. And you had seen some of it, certainly the episodes that were filmed in here. When Mike first came, he wanted to film the buildings, and he thought that he might look at a Latin lesson, which was a staged Latin lesson. The Latin teacher taught from this end, and he wore a gown and did it in a very sort of question and answer mode, which is not how they do Latin, of course, and he doesn't teach in a gown. But that's what they wanted for the programme. When Mike was in, we got to talk, and he invited us to do a few scenes from plays that were relevant. So one of the things he was interested in is trying out a school play. So Udall's Ralph Royster Doister. And we did some excerpts in this space. Again, for the camera, they were very short little excerpts. And it wouldn't have hung together as a performance, but the bits that were filmed looked fine, and that's what they wanted. And another thing he was interested in was looking at boys playing women.
Okay, because everybody knows, one of the things that everybody knows about the early modern playhouse was that all the roles were played by men and their apprentices, boys from age 7 on upwards until the point where their voices broke, where they began to play adult male parts. But you were exploring not the professional kind of playing or professional repertoire. You were looking at the kinds of plays that were written and performed in school as part of the school's curriculum.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you have the advantage over me because you were immediately able to say the kind of ages at which they performed and how long they went on for. And I didn't know that. I knew the standard idea that all the women's parts were first played by boys, but what boys meant, I had no idea. So it could be a 7-year-old, it could have been a 19-year-old, you know, it could have been somebody who'd been working for years and years within the company, or somebody that was, you know, I didn't know these things. Mike posed a particular challenge with a translation from the 1570s of Seneca. Yeah, was it Seneca's Hecuba? That's right. So we did two scenes from that, two longer scenes. And the boy who played the role of Hecuba did a series of laments. And he shot it and it worked up to a point.
Okay, now I watched that documentary.
Yeah.
And I came back to you having seen it, and I said, I want to do more. I want to explore more, and I want to test some of the ideas that had just been had been introduced in that project. And one of the things that I was particularly interested in was that question that has occupied performance students for a long time about this whole the whole business of cross-dressing, of boys becoming women, of boys taking on the women's parts and playing those parts and answering the question or trying to get at that question of why it was that William Shakespeare, student in this place, was able to write such extraordinary parts for women right from the beginning of his career. So I asked you if we could do some more exploring and think about the grammar school curriculum, what was on that curriculum, and the kinds of exercises that boys were given specifically the exercise that was called an ithopoia, that is the speech for a character, that was frequently derived from Ovid, specifically perhaps from the Heroides, which are those women's letters complaining to the men who've dumped them, or the men who've left them on Naxos, about their grievances. So these letters that are sent by women to those men who betrayed them, that are spoken from the point of view of the woman. And we know that Shakespeare used the Heroides. We know that Shakespeare must have memorized probably Ariadne's letter. And I asked you if we could think about that curriculum and set the boys the task of recovering this curriculum and testing out that part of becoming, let's say, as we did, Ariadne. Now, what was your take on all of that? What was your interest in all of that?
Well, let's go back to the bit we did for the Shakespeare program. It was never included in what the BBC put out because it kind of worked, but it wasn't good enough. And there was a boy who was 14, who I'd chosen deliberately because he had a bit of acting talent, and I knew he wouldn't be phased by playing a female role. Mm-hmm. But in the end, the challenge proved too much for him. And it probably proved too much for me as well. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I'd ever tried to direct a boy playing a woman's part. Yeah. And it was very theatrical in the sense that you saw the rushes. So you were able to see what the great British public didn't see. So at the other end, we set up at a makeup table, and the costume he wore was gorgeous, and the makeup and wigs all came from the RSC. And although it was set up as though a boy was making this his schoolmate up, it wasn't the case at all. It was an RSC makeup person who was coming in doing all of that, and then she got out of shot, and this boy was doing. So it was all artificial.
Right. Uh-huh.
And everything was very elaborate, and look, he's playing a woman, so we'll put lots and lots of eyeliner and lipstick and so on. You get the idea. Now, that may or may not approximate what happened in the Elizabethan theatre. But what it did for that boy, it just overwhelmed him with makeup and costume, and he never really found what he was supposed to be doing. So I was grateful. I mean, I was grateful because it was an interesting piece of work that we were going to do. But I was grateful to go back and try to start working properly on those kind of pieces. Mm-hmm. So when you said, let's have a look at the kind of things that would have been on the curriculum, that was interesting for a start because these were pieces of work that I didn't know at all. So you showed me the Heroides and the translations we were going to use, and we did a bit of work on those, and we looked at the translation by...
We looked at the Golding translation of Metamorphosis.
Right, which was extraordinary and unspeakable. You know, you looked at it, how are people ever going to convey this? So that was a really interesting challenge. Then you started saying, well, let's also see how it can be linked in with what Shakespeare actually wrote. So my memory is that we performed, in the end, something like 13 discrete pieces.
Okay, because what
but
we were
doing... before that, you'd thrown loads.
Yeah.
And then
because
you did Johnson.
Part of the bee that I had in my bonnet was that perhaps cross-dressing for the boys had been thought about academically in terms of costume.
Yeah.
That it was what was put on the body, and that the body becoming female was somehow eroticized. And I wanted to explore the idea of cross-dressing textually, of saying that the boys became women rhetorically taking on these female texts.
That's absolutely what happened, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you saw the rushes of the Hecuba that Michael Wood did, and if you like, there was nothing inside the costume. Mm-hmm. And then we went with the text, first of all, and spent several hours with different groups of boys going through bits of text that, first of all, seemed odd because they'd have to play a woman, but also odd because it was impenetrable stuff, odd because the references were kind of way beyond their knowledge, and all these sorts of reasons why it was difficult. And of course, you do what you do with any play, don't you? You start to try and understand what the words mean.
Okay, but let's just think about those extracts. So we had Ariadne from the Heroides lamenting her betrayal by Theseus. We looked at Hecuba when Hecuba discovers that all of her children now have been killed. And the body of the one child that she thinks has been saved rolls up in front of her to be the twin of her daughter Polyxena.
Dido.
We looked at Dido, and then we moved into spaces in Shakespeare where he was clearly, in some respects, remembering those women's parts. Yep. So we looked at the Two Gentlemen of Verona,
which was the most explicit, wasn't it?
Was the explicit where he is remembering being Ariadne.
Yep.
But then we looked at Cleopatra.
Yeah.
We looked at Olivia and Viola, and one of the things that I found kind of wonderful about it is that at no point did the boys themselves have any problem playing across.
No.
They weren't self-conscious, they weren't fey, they weren't giggly. What they did was to pick up the texts and start playing with that text.
Absolutely right. And you know, it sounds cliche, or it sounds too simple to say, well, that's what you do with any play. But it is. You know, if you're playing a king, he has to start thinking about what a king does and how people react to him as a king and all that, and get that inner life sorted, understand what the words mean, and then he's got a chance to sort of play.
And there was that marvellous point, isn't it? We borrowed a load of corsets.
Yep.
And we put the boys into the woman's shape, and then they started standing differently. And I think it's safe to say that they had an interesting time. And it was something they wanted to do again.
That's right.
They wanted to take the experiment further themselves.
There were 13 different pieces we did, including some bits from Jonson as well, which posed a different kind of linguistic problem, because the scenes from Epicene were really dense and difficult and full of really quite challenging prose. But they learned things from all of them. And at no point, as you say, were they embarrassed or awkward about it, but they wanted to play more. I mean, the most successful comment was from the boy who played the Cleopatra, who was, as you remember, frustrated having done Cleopatra in two scenes because he realised he'd never play that part again.
Yeah.
And it gave, he thought, such scope for that sign of emotional self-indulgence. And he was really sorry about it. And in fact, you might remember one of the performances, Stanley Wells came and saw it, and Stanley said afterwards he'd like to see that boy play Cleopatra.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of thing. Not only were they not scared of it, they wanted to do more of
it. Okay, so that was our prep.
Yep.
And now we go forward 2 years
to
extending the project even further. We decided that we would choose a play and start to work on this play from the point of view of, not just extracts, but trying to get as much of the play on its feet as we can, as we could.
We were limited slightly by the invitation from the Globe.
Okay, well, let's just go back, just keep on that for a moment, because out of a series of coincidences, the Globe, Shakespeare's Globe in London, invited you to bring to a conference the kind of performance that we were already imagining. So these two things came. They wanted a boys' company. These two things came together. So what we chose was our new experiment was to find a play that had been originally written for the boys' companies. Now there was a vogue of boys' companies attached to the choir schools in the 1580s. They then were closed down and seemed to have come back into they were reanimated
in the early 1600s,
in around 1599. Those are the boy players that Hamlet is talking about when he's quizzing the tragedians of the city and saying, you know, why have you left the city? And the actors say, oh, it's because these little eye-asses are all the rage now. Now, there is Hamlet actually talking about real life in 1599-1600 London at about the time that that Hamlet is being written. So we found a play of 1605 written by a younger colleague of Shakespeare's, John Marston, called The Dutch Courtesan.
Yeah.
a play that doesn't seem to have had any performance history professionally for at least 50 years, a play that is largely unread, has no exposure to the public, but it was a play in which boys would be playing young men, but also in which boys would be playing women.
Yeah.
The title role of the piece, The Dutch Courtesan, figures a woman who, like Ariadne and Dido and others that the boys from the original project had in mind, features a woman who is significantly betrayed. Now, could you just give us a synopsis of this play?
We wanted a play that was a boys' play, and that was already shifting away a little bit from the ground that I've been looking at before with you, which was primarily focusing on the boys playing women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here it was going to be a boys' company,
yeah.
So they would play the women, as you say, but there was also a boy in the cast of this one.
Yeah.
So whatever age we decide that's going to be, that's quite interesting. And then, of course, they're playing men, some of them old men, and old women, of course, but also young men about town. And I think although the Dutch Courtesan, as you say, is the title, and she's certainly the one that everybody remembers because it's a remarkable character, I think, the real focal point is a couple of blokes, and they're young men about town. And when I was starting...
Significantly named Frivel.
Frivel and...
Malheureux.
Malheureux. when I was first reading it and thinking about it, it just leapt out at me that these are young undergraduates with all the kind of misbehaviour and so forth and attitudes towards money and women and so on that you'd expect of those kind of men and that kind of class.
Mm-hmm.
And then realising that it's set in London, but London was very much the kind of the Oxford or Cambridge at the same time because it was set in and around the Inns of Court. And Marston was at the Inns of Court himself, so with his legal background. So he was writing that kind of play.
A kind of masculinity.
A kind of, you know, these young men, it seemed to me, are probably 19, 20, 21 years old. They're on the cusp themselves and trying stuff out.
Yeah.
So that was interesting as well to get boys who were practically that age and getting up to practically those same sorts of experiences and then having
Don't tell their mothers.
Which, you know, we think, oh, it's so difficult to play a Dutch courtesan because that's totally out of their experience. In some ways, it's just as difficult to play something that should be close to them because, of course, the thing that they naturally do is reproduce a kind of a series of tricks.
Okay. So at the centre of this play, we have Frivel,
who's
the lad.
That's right.
And his friend, who is...
Malheureux. Well, Frivel is Jack the Lad, as you say, a young man about town and doesn't have any problem with enjoying life and partying. Malheureux is different. He's his friend, but his problem is that he's
buttoned up.
There's this kind of Puritanism about him. So he certainly thinks that brothels and that kind of relationship with women is totally unacceptable. And so they're a kind of Little and Large, or you know, Laurel and Hardy, or something. They're different sides, and there is this relationship that clearly, when the players started, had been going on for some time between Frivel and the Dutch courtesan.
Okay.
This is his kind of pet prostitute that he goes to, and he goes and enjoys himself with her, and then moves on. She falls in love with Frivel, and there's the real problem in the entire
And of course, thing. when Frivel moves on, what he's moving on to or moving on from is the illicit relationship, and now moving into a licit relationship. So he's courting Bianca, the beautiful young woman who is going to bring him a marriage that is going to be recognized, is going to
acceptable,
be solemnized, it's
status,
blah, blah, blah,
money,
and
all of that sort of thing. Okay. I mean, typically, you know. You go to your prostitute for that sort of relationship, and Frivel has no problem with the hypocrisy behind that.
So,
but if you're going to get married, you don't marry courtesans.
So meanwhile, the courtesan has fallen in love with Frivel.
Yep.
Frivel is dumping the courtesan in order to make this marriage.
Yep.
Malheureux is appalled that his friend consorts with a courtesan.
But the problem is, the moment he sees her,
he falls in love with her.
Okay. Love.
Well,
that's the problem.
Okay,
it's not so much love as just immediate lust, isn't it? That he's completely, and he's very embarrassed, and Marston makes it clear through some of the language. Yeah. He's very embarrassed by his physical response
right.
to her.
Meanwhile, we have the secondary cast of characters who are doing the kind of low life japing
the kind of city comedy kind of
Coney catching and so on.
The key figure there is this guy called Cockle de Moy. And Cockle de Moy is a lad about town as well, but significantly of a lower social class than Freeville. And it seemed to us, through the text, they don't get on at all, Freeville and Cockle de Moy. They recognise the kind of characters each other is, and they don't want anything to do with each other. They meet, but they kind of, in our production, they kind of often circled each other because they don't like...
Okay, so Cockle de Moy is the one who is the centre of this mayhem.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
He
but
goes
also,
and steals
also involved in this is, in terms of the female side of the play, we have the Dutch courtesan who has her sidekick, her bawd, Mary Foe. Then we have Bianca, the licit lady, and we have Bianca's sister, whose name is Crispinella.
Yeah.
Now, so we have a man's side of the play, we have a woman's side of the play, and these plays, these two plays that are in, you know, incendiary, you know, combustion with each other. Now, we start with this, you reading this play, seeing what's there as an opportunity for these young men, But it's also, of course, unlike Shakespeare, we have no cultural memory of the kind of lines that Marston is working on. It's all foreign to these lads when they pick up the text for the first time. And I remember it was in a very, very cold sixth form room in January when all the heating was on, where we all sat around a table. The boys had been assigned their parts. They had the scripts in front of them. And they started reading, and it was like molasses.
It was
impenetrable, wasn't it?
There are a series of things that were different about this. We've been asked to do something for the Globe, and it fitted in. But they asked for 20 minutes, which we eventually squeezed out to 45 minutes because we wanted something more substantial. And the reason we wanted it to be more substantial is that we wanted to include the female roles.
Yeah.
And actually the females don't appear in the first couple of scenes, really.
Yeah.
It's a bit later on. And we pushed it to the end of Act 3, Scene 1 with a bit of cutting. And that meant we had all of those four characters you mentioned, but there was also, if you remember, Mistress Mullygrub as well.
Yes.
So there was an additional woman, a different one, different class again, sort of works as the landlady in the local pub. Her husband's the vintner, but also older. So she's going to be older, and it enabled us also to get Bianca's nurse, which was a nice comparison with what people might know from their knowledge of Romeo and Juliet, to have her nurse, another older figure.
Yeah.
So it got us the opportunity to have, I think, six different women of different kinds in if we went up that far.
Yeah. So just as you had from the men's side,
The
youngest was actually the apprentice.
Yeah.
He was in as part of the narrative.
Yeah.
He's the apprentice lad playing a boy right the way up through to these marriageable young men. So equally on the women's side, you had the budding version, the blushing bride, all the way up to the grey-haired nurse who was trying to look after these young women. Okay, but just take me through the rehearsal process.
Well, you see, The casting had to be different as well for this because we were under real pressure of time, and because if we were taking it outside school, we came to Capital as well as to the Globe and other places, we wanted it to be really good. So normally with a play, I'd open it to complete free auditions. People come along and say, I'd like to be in the play. But I didn't want to do that with this because I didn't want to disappoint lots and lots of people. So I invited particular people. I invited them basically on talent. And to a large extent because I've worked with them before. Because, thank goodness, I suspected from the work that we'd done on the Thisbe project that it's really useful to build up on stuff you've done before, in a way to get a kind of company feel, so things can change over time. So there were some of the characters that you'd worked with before as well, like Oliver and Jack and so forth, and then some new ones, but that was really helpful for me. So it meant that I was able to choose, if you like, boys I thought were sufficiently talented to cope with this stuff, and also age ranges. I wanted to make sure that we had young, so the youngest was 11, right the way through to the senior boys in the school, so the oldest were 18. And we pretty much represented every age group, every year group through that, which I think was interesting rather than just narrowing it
down.
But
also by luck, as much as by judgment, what you were doing was creating an ensemble.
I think that's absolutely right.
A boy playing company.
Absolutely.
And bringing those kids together who bonded together and who worked as a team right from the off.
Now, this stage, sort of the November time, I still hadn't done any academic research, really. I'd looked at, you know, the introduction to one or two plays and things, but that was it. I had no idea how old these boys might actually have been at the real at the time they were originally performed. It was only later on, after I made the decisions, quite by chance, that I was reading that they could have been played by 17 and 18 and 19-year-old apprentices and possibly even older, which I thought was really interesting and a vindication of some of the decisions we'd made. But I'll come on to that later. We did the first rehearsal. It was in terrible physical conditions, as you say, because it was dark and cold. And also, Freeville, the lad playing Freeville, wasn't available. So one of the main parts wasn't there to read it. And they were confronted, as you say, by this really difficult text. It was difficult because there were lots of words they didn't recognise. Difficult because it was very very much lawyer's jargon and all sorts of lawyer's jokes. And what we afterwards started to talk about, the way arguments develop for lawyers and examples are given forward and all that sort of thing. But also it was filthy. Completely filthy, and although the boys, once it had been carefully explained to them, could pick up on the filth, at first it just seemed rubbish. It literally nonsense. So that first rehearsal was, in a sense, terribly difficult, but two things came out of it. One, it really gave me a sense of this play is going to work, and I know exactly which scene it was in. It was quite late on, and the reading was going very badly at that stage. People were sort of just giving up in the middle of lines, and you know, they were reading things, and you'd even stop correcting them for mispronunciation. It was getting so late and so cold, and it was the scene where the Dutch courtesan has been publicly rejected by Freeville, which in the eventual performance was probably one of the most affecting moments in the entire thing. And after that, she decides she's going to get him. And she's going to use his best friend Malheureux to get back at him. And Malheureux, because he's so completely overcome with lust for this woman, agrees to betray his friend.
Agrees to kill him.
Agrees to kill him. And in the course of that dialogue that was haltingly read, and that's a compliment, it was terribly read by the two lads. I thought, I know this. We can get this, because it's that uneasy. Even when they were reading it badly, it was funny and also awkward. And I think that, so that was one great thing that came out of that afternoon. I thought, I know we can get this tone somehow. And the other thing was that they all stayed to the end, because it was so difficult that you could almost have imagined them going away saying, this is just horrible. What, in 5 weeks, we've got to put this on in London in front of people who know? So the fact that they did stay to the end, and that we know that part of it was that sense of excitement, because they were doing something for a variety of reasons that was different. We don't normally do plays in that way in school. The younger ones were really excited to be acting with some of the older ones who they've seen in other plays. Yeah. We're going to London. We're going on tour. There's Professor Carol Rutter there.
But in
it's
some
a naughty,
sense...
It's a naughty
it's
play.
A naughty play.
There were a series of things that really attracted them to that experience. Mm. And if it sounds like a lot of little boys, they are a lot of little boys. And that's what they got out of those early days, I think.
But in some sense, too, all of the boys were cross-dressing.
Yeah.
That is, Oliver Hayes, who was going to be playing Freeville, was cross-dressing into this kind of kind of Oxbridge kind of adolescent, irresponsible with women. He was cross-dressing in that direction in the same way that that Harry Davis, who played the Dutch courtesan, was going to be cross-dressing in putting on women's clothes. Now, you made what I think of as a brilliant directorial choice early on in deciding not to try to put this play into period dress to set it in 1605, no matter what the language was doing, but to choose another visual regime, vocabulary. Tell me about that.
It was the way we made practically every decision, which was, you know, talking about it in rehearsal.
Ensemble.
Absolutely. We didn't make any firm decisions about period or costume or any of that for 2 or 3 weeks. First thing we did in every single rehearsal was sit down around a table and go through the text. And sometimes there was one rehearsal early on where we did 6 lines in an hour and a half.
Just
we
word did six bashing. Lines.
Word bashing, but what we did was get into the kind of humour of the play.
Right.
That rehearsal was the one where I was trying to explain an incredibly complex, silly joke. And that was when the boy said, "Oh, it's a mum joke." And they all nodded to each other, and that's where I had to start to learn what a mum joke is. And they gave me plenty of contemporary examples, and it was great because that gave them confidence. Because what this guy's getting at is something they do. It's teenage argo. It's chatting. It's using irony. It's playing around with language all the time, which every social group does, whatever level they're at.
But the boys also cut through your own embarrassment, didn't they? That is, I think I can remember one of them telling me about your anguished explanation of a particularly filthy joke, and he put his hand up and said,
"I defend myself here."
He means sodomy, doesn't he, sir? They passed on, or is that just apocryphal?
That's a myth.
It's a good myth.
It belongs in the story. But
that's
the BBC television approach, which it's a better story than mine. But I'll be absolutely frank. I don't get embarrassed with them, with these references at all. And I think that does help, but also it's a kind of trust thing. Yeah, and we talked about all of those references and what they meant and so forth, but not in any kind of creepy way, not for any other reason apart from you've got to know what he's talking about. Now, are we going to cut it? Are we keep it in? Or are you going to make it work? Right. And that's what we did all the way through.
Right.
So one of the things we learned was trust. You know, they had to trust me, because to have a sort of 47-year-old or whatever teacher dealing with this material could be creepy. But we trusted each other. And we have a laugh, and whether it's whatever sexual practice, we have a laugh and then move on. And it's not like something we get awkward about. That, I think, did come across in performance.
Okay, so you've got, to begin with then, this hard, disciplined work on the text.
Yeah.
Understanding what the text is so that they can occupy the text,
Absolutely.
So they can own the text. Yeah. And through that owning of the text, I think what you were partly discovering was the playfulness of the text and how they could play with the text.
Okay? Completely. From early on, I'd explain to them, we were supposed to be doing 20 minutes, but this could be about 45 at the moment, so we're really going to have to crack on. Now, that did very much help with the approach they were always going to take. So once they learnt their lines and they knew what it meant, they heard from the beginning that it had to have real pace and rhythm. And of course, that releases all sorts of things. It's not the kind of play where you actually follow, as a member of the audience, every twist and turn of the argument, because it's too blooming fast. But what you do is it's like the verbal tennis or whatever kind of analogy you want. It's that pinging around the stage. And I think practically every member of the audience that has spoken to me after the performance said about that energy that came through. And they were doing a lot of physical stuff on stage, but I think that the energy primarily was that verbal energy. The wit was flying around, and that was palpable, I think.
Yeah.
But it can only come from they know what they're doing, they know what they're supposed to be saying, and then they can
release
it.
Okay, then out of that comes your design decision.
Yeah. Now, as I say, that wasn't 3 weeks into the process, probably, and we probably performed after 5.5 weeks, so it was quite late on. We knew it was going to be a bare stage, so it wasn't that we were going to have to build a set, so that wasn't the complication. Complication was how we were going to get the costumes and props in time. Because we'd spent so much of our time in rehearsals relating what we were doing, what the text was suggesting to our own experiences and lives, it just seemed natural, that it wasn't going to be in contemporary costume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was then going to, okay, so if it's going to be modern dress, how modern?
Yes.
Were we going to go for today?
Yeah.
Or were we going to go for something in the recent past, but something that people could recognise? And that was where we ended up. And because it was pretty much because of the Oxbridge Young Men About Town, one member of the cast said in a rehearsal, well, why don't we do a kind of Jeeves and Wooster, P.G. Woodhouse kind of world for it?
Let's put it in blazers.
And then we thought, yeah, because everybody knows that kind of Jeeves and Wooster kind of world of young men behaving like silly twits, and then the people behind them trying to nick their pockets and so on, and they're prostitutes throughout the ages. So thinking, right, okay, which particular... So we decided it was the 1920s, did a quick bit of research, and then got the things together very quickly. When the boy who played Bianca, Johnny, was set up, he wore his sister's dress, very...
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that 1920s fashions are back in. So it was quite useful to get hold of the costumes.
Read other people's wardrobes.
And also the hair, it was very, very easy because a couple of the girls who helped us with the production, it was just modelled on their own hair as well. So that was all very, very helpful. We didn't have to go with some of the characters into wigs or any of that stuff we started with talking
okay,
about
the Michael Rook. I want to talk about the three principal women, okay?
Yeah.
So we have Bianca, whom you've just described,
yeah.
she is the gorgeous, approved, to be wooed and won and married woman, and it's played by Johnny
Clowes, and Johnny
who is one of the smallest
of the
company. He's only tiny,
yeah.
And this Bianca was to begin with set up in a window to be seen and to be adored.
Yes.
Okay, so we have that, and what was uncanny in performance was that Johnny, when people looked at him, saw him as a girl.
My colleague who watched a late run, who's a drama teacher, sent me a note while it was going on saying, Johnny is a girl.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what everyone assumed.
That's number one. Then we had the Dutch courtesan herself, played by Harry Davies.
Mm.
And Harry took on the dress almost of a flapper, a long feather boa, more or less his own hair, slightly styled, but then had this extraordinary voice. Of course, she's the Dutch courtesan, and as Marston writes the script, he's writing it in a cod Dutch kind of phonetics. Harry took that on and became a kind of, what, Marlena Dietrich
figure? That was very much one of the...
Edith Piaf?
Yeah, that's exactly.
A low voice, a gravelly voice, a voice that had smoked far too many caps and cigarettes.
But you see, when he did the first song, chose to do it as a kind of torch song, a blues torch song, which
because of course the courtesan is an entertainer.
Oh yeah.
And as Harry he played this part, he had a huge repertoire of things that he had to do.
Yeah.
You know, not just to come on and be the courtesan, but to have this extraordinary range of emotions from being in love with Freeville to discovering that Freeville was going to throw her over, and then doing an amazing aria of rage and violence that then turned into a seduction of this other character, Malheureuse, in order to manipulate him into killing Freeville in revenge.
Mm.
So we have that role, okay, and there is Harry in that place, yes. But the third role is Crispinella.
Yep.
And Crispinella is Bianca's sister.
Very forceful.
She's the Beatrice character out of Much Ado. She's the one who challenges male opinions and male fantasies and male conventions. She's the one who kind of takes on the business of being female in a man's world. So what decisions did you make about her?
Well, it's why I wanted to get to Act 3, Scene 1. Because she doesn't appear till Act 3, Scene 1. And as the play develops, her character becomes much more important, and a subplot between a character we haven't mentioned yet called Tisiphew, She and Tissafue, Crispinella and Tissafue, get together and end up getting married. And that seems to be the one that with the relationship we're supposed to look at and think, ah, yeah, that's good, because these two would spark off each other.
So it's Kate and Petruchio, yeah, Beatrice and Benedict.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. And I very much wanted to get to Crispinella because she introduces, as you've implied, something different. Well, I think what's interesting, if you go through the reactions of the audience to the three of them, Johnny is 12 and looks angelic, he's blonde hair, big round eyes, and so putting him in his sister's dress with a little demure cardigan on and nicely made up through the picture frame, the audience did, as you say, all think that is a girl and gasped. Mm-hmm. It was better, I think, that he was 12 than he was 17 to play that part. I think it fitted in with that image of purity and innocence, and the way that it developed was safer with a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. Something different was going on. You couldn't have had a 12-year-old, I think, play the Dutch courtesan. And Harry is 16, and he was able to inhabit it in a different way. In part, what we did, of course, was make use of the stereotype of the exotic, erotic, prostitute, heavily made up, bare arms, using the boa. And you said she's an entertainer in the text. She plays the lute for that first song. So her hands would be engaged playing the lute. Harry doesn't play the guitar, so we had another lad play the guitar to accompany him. But of course, that left his hands free, and you will remember that he manipulated Malora and really enjoyed the flirtatious game.
Yeah.
For the benefit of Freeville, it was a kind of game she was playing. So there was all of that. We used that stereotype, and then of course the audience eventually discovered something else. And what they were, there were shrieks of laughter in the performance, particularly here, when people recognised Harry dressed up like that, which was almost uncontrollable. And then they controlled it. And then they really controlled the audience and the silences.
Well, I mean, what was going on there was that the audience thought that they were seeing a comedy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what we discover is that the play is the tragedy of the Dutch courtesan. And there is a moment when, out of that exchange of rejection, where the Dutch courtesan is hanging on to Freeville and wanting his ring, Freeville pushes her, and then in your production, violently hit her, so she sprawled on the floor. At which point, the audience went very, very silent.
And so they learned other things, having, you know, if you like, reacted to the woman first of all as a stereotype, and then she's a much more rich character.
So it pulled the ground up from the audience.
And of course, one of the things that we discovered that is that two lads who are 17 and 16, respectively, can push and hit each other in a way that a boy cannot hit a girl, wouldn't it? You know, it'd be something different on stage if it was with a girl.
Or indeed, that he could not have had that relationship with Johnny. That is,
absolutely,
because they were matched. Because physically, in terms of age and maturity, they were matched. They could play with each other with a kind of audacity and a kind of intensity that was not going to be possible elsewhere.
The real point of that, of course, was the kissing.
Yeah,
and we did.
I want to go there in a moment. But tell us about Crispinella.
Right, now we're getting to Crispinella, and it seemed to me, this was quite late on, that Crispinella, being this forceful blue stocking who was very clever with language, as witty as the men and wittier, as filthy as the men and filthier, and enjoyed not just provoking the men, but enjoyed provoking her own sister as well, who was very much a free spirit. And it just seemed to me, come on, if we're talking 1920s, the obvious thing is to have her dressed as a man. That was her statement. So she was in a suit, she had a cigarette in a long holder, she had a monocle that she would use, and you know, it was a challenge to people who met her. And it was
Jamie,
a challenge to the audience.
Jamie Houghton, who played Crispinella. And then the audience had a kind of a double take.
Yeah.
Because they're seeing this boy playing a woman, but dressed as a man.
Which threw a number of people, and it was supposed to be confusing.
It was supposed to be disconcerting. In the way that women wearing trousers should have been disconcerting.
And in the way that this play is disconcerting, constantly, wherever you think you know where you are, Marston pulls the rug from under you. And that was probably the most explicit and obvious example. And several people said, even at the end, what was going on there? Yeah. And then when you sort of nudge them in that direction, then everybody said, oh yeah, yeah. So I think it's vindicated as a kind of design decision.
Yes.
And certainly Jamie really enjoyed it because it allowed him a kind of freedom that he probably wouldn't have had if he was dressed in a
dress. It's another way of testing the conventions and the mores and the expectations of everybody who is in the play, but also everybody who's in the audience. Now, I wonder if you can just talk about some of the real challenges to the rehearsal and performance.
Yeah.
There's a point in the scene between, the first scene between the Dutch courtesan and Frevel, in which she has to kiss him.
Yeah, yeah, and it, I mean, there are three kisses explicitly written in the text as stage directions, and then there are other opportunities to kiss if we wanted to. And it seemed to me clear that there was going to be something different in the relationship between a 17-year-old boy and his 12-year-old mistress, in the way we represented that physically.
Yeah.
And the difference between that 17-year-old boy and his 16-year-old courtesan.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally, both Oliver and Harry are very experienced at doing plays. Neither of them have a problem with working in rehearsal or trying things out. So the question of a kiss was not going to offend them at all or make them feel awkward.
Mm-hmm.
It did make one or two members of the cast feel awkward. But I'd spoken to them on a particular day, separately, not trying to keep it secret from each other, just as I bumped into them around school. And I think that kind of thing is really helpful because it's, okay, we're not going to talk about the kiss now. It's not, it's just I bump into them in school and I said to Ollie, when you get to the kiss tonight, I think it'd be a good idea to do it. Fine, yeah, okay, he said, boom, get on with it. Same with Harry, yeah, okay, no problem. We didn't prepare for it, just got to the bit. Now, these two kiss each other in the text, clearly, fervently and
passionately,
lustfully.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Passionately. You say passion, I say lust.
But they, I'm such a romantic.
Yeah, they absolutely went for it. To the extent that open mouths and everything. Now, this caused consternation in the rehearsal, partly for the two boys, because when they came apart, there was a stagger. Everybody else who was, you know, this ensemble cast, suddenly it was something different. The little boys, well, the one who was playing Bianca, Johnny, thought for a minute, this is going to happen to me later, and was terrified. Another one became very interested in his rugby magazine. One of the women in the room, who was helping as stage manager, used to go out with Oliver, so she thought it was incredibly funny what was going on.
Yep.
There were real reactions. We talked about it, of course, afterwards as a kind of laugh and so on, and that was great, and they were happy with it, not a problem. But that evening, Oliver emailed me about it because I'd asked them to keep a record, and he was already getting very excited about the first performance because he wanted to know how an audience would react to that kiss because they knew they had something kind of electric there. Now, there was a real challenge for expectation and convention and so on. We couldn't do it in another way.
Well, you didn't, but in performance, you didn't duck it.
No.
The Dutch courtesan had on heavy red lipstick.
Yeah.
And the kiss was not just a kiss. The kiss became almost a brand across the face because there was the lipstick that was smeared across Frevel's face. And he was then, for the rest of the scene, marked as having
absolutely
been in this
right
relationship with the Dutch courtesan.
Yeah.
And I remember with the audience, there being a kind of a gasp when that happened. Okay, so there's the kiss, there's the physical sexuality that's going on, and the erotic exchange, the erotic charge that's being presented. Okay, what about the violence in the play?
Yeah, as I've said, if you've got boys working on stage together, you don't ever want to do anything that's dangerous. Of course, they can't get hurt, but they can explore their physicality more. There was one moment of extreme violence, which you've already described, where Frevel casts aside very, very violently the Dutch courtesan, Frankestrina, and she falls to the floor and then spends quite a long time getting herself back up and getting her dignity back. It had to be that violent to create the response. And it did. Again, I don't think.
But there was also wonderfully. There was much more violence in the show that would be come under the heading of just roustabout.
Oh yes, that.
So
now,
you
that,
opened
yeah.
you opened the show yeah. by doing well. The opening of
they
the play
on,
is a long narrative
yeah.
device.
Yeah.
And what you decided to do was not just have the speech. But while Freeville is telling this long, complicated tale about some bowls that got stolen and somebody was blind and a room
yeah,
and a this
yeah.
and a that and so on, what your boys did was to play, to mime yeah. the whole thing and to show us the
yeah.
events in physical theatre.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's what you find in a lot of plays, isn't it? You know, we'll help you to find out who these characters are
yeah.
by pointing these things up.
Yeah.
But it's what you find with groups of boys standing around, and I no doubt groups of girls as well, but groups of boys, when they're trying to tell you a really good story about what happened on Saturday night, they'll be up and about and doing the bits and engaging with it. So that's how we did it. So it did make it more clear to the audience because it was very difficult text. But the great thing is people didn't notice it was difficult, I don't think, because they were laughing at the sheer joie de vivre of these kids who were on each other's shoulders, who were doing somersaults, who were leaping and wrapping their legs around each other's waists.
With horns and balloons and party hats
and so on. And it was that sense of play
yeah.
that ran through the production and the rehearsal process. Because, as I've said to you on many occasions, they are just a group of boys.
Yeah.
One of the nicest comments afterwards came when we performed at the Globe and a couple of parents who had nothing to do with us wanted to buy everyone a round of drinks in the bar, which they didn't, of course, but were talking to Malera, the guy who played Malera,
yeah.
and said, well, the amazing thing is we've seen you perform that and you were extremely good and completely convincing and now you're just boys.
Yeah.
And he very sensibly said, well, that's what we are.
My role in the theatre is audience. I see myself as a kind of professional spectator. And what I bring to the theatre is my observation. I help to make the show because I'm there, the person out there in front. And I know that having participated in this project across the year, that what I know what I got out of it. And it was that kind of visible excitement of seeing performed at a real level of engagement and seriousness,
yeah.
having tested it, the business of the cross-dressing, of seeing the boys becoming women under the pressure of emotion.
Do you think we were at any point camp?
No, not at all. And that was what was wonderful about it.
We were trying to avoid that.
But that was because it seems to me that comes out of your rehearsal process
yeah.
of occupying the language and doing exactly what the language is asking you to do. So I know what I got out of it.
Yeah.
What did the boys get out of it?
You know, any time you do a play, you're going to learn things. They learnt a tremendous amount. I mean, they learnt an awful lot about being a company. Which was
uh-huh.
probably the most important
yeah.
thing. They learnt a great deal about playing different spaces.
Mm-hmm.
The first time they performed it in front of an audience
yeah.
was at your Capital Centre, a sort of a blank box with audience on three sides. Then they performed here in Big School in a different atmosphere and a very different set up to the stage,
yeah.
Then down to a proscenium arch theatre, then to a sort of indoor Elizabethan thrust stage.
Yeah.
So they learnt a very great deal about performance spaces. They learnt an enormous amount about the way you take on difficult text.
Mm-hmm.
All of them really appreciated, they're not just telling me that, really appreciated the rehearsal process and
right.
unpicking what this stuff means and then finding ways of making it live and making it come alive and communicate with people. So that gave them huge confidence, I know, to the other projects they've moved on to. They learnt a huge amount about the relationship between men and women, inhabiting those roles. The Harry who played the courtesan, it altered his attitude and his ideas about women and about prostitutes and about attitudes towards prostitution, both male and female,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So there's those kind of explicit ones. And he wasn't the only member of the cast. Several of them, with Matt Cameron said at one point in a rehearsal, to Harry as the courtesan,
yeah.
I feel really sorry for you.
Yeah.
So they learned an enormous amount about those kind of difficult relationships. And I think I'd come back to this importance of play. They did have a thoroughly good time, even down to messing about backstage at the Globe just before going on, to such an extent that one of the very little boys was nearly injured. Mm-hmm. And then they had to sort of apologise and calm down and remember, but then get on and do the show. And I think that they did sort out the way that it's important to play and then to put play away in its box and get on with the job of work and do the job of work.
Because, you know, that we have a crisis, a continuing crisis in schools about what boys learn they learn. And if it's possible to teach emotional literacy to young men and where they get that. I mean, is this the kind of project that you think, not to recruit it to pedagogy and that kind of...
No.
But is this a place where emotional... Is that what those texts were doing, do you think, on the original school's curriculum in Shakespeare's days?
Well, I think some of those texts that we explored a few years ago, that's definitely the case. Yeah. And I think that doing a play brings about those kinds of results... Yeah. If it's done in the right spirit, I would say.
I mean, it, what struck me in watching them was that there were boys who were not just becoming women, there were boys who were seriously thinking about the consequences of being male.
So
it wasn't just Matt saying to the courtesan, I'm feeling sorry for you. I think it was the range of boys who were thinking, what are the implications of my behaviours, and where is that going to go? And the hypocrisy that is acculturated, that is perfectly acceptable in that play about, you know, throwing over the woman you use in order to have the approved marriage with the woman, and then Crispinella in the centre being a kind of adjudicator and a questioner about these mores. But those men occupying that text were learning, it seems to me, something about being male.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And it ain't easy. No, that's absolutely right. I mean, the guy playing Freeville, Oliver, emailed me at one point and said, how difficult for me as a 17-year-old lad having to think about sex all the time, as a joke. On the other hand, he was the first one to say that Freeville behaves appallingly at these moments. Yeah. I think it is, it is a wonderfully educational experience.
But in the rich way.
Because the moment you tie it in with kind of national curriculum and targets, of course, it dwindles, because it's that lightness. You learn these things whilst thinking of something else, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's exactly the value. You know, I do still have a lot of thinking to do about the sex in this play.
Yes.
In the sense that we've talked about the kissing, and I still don't know whether it was right for them to kiss in that way. It was right in terms of the show, because it created the response. But I'm not certain that I know what I mean by it, whether it was right, but is that what would have happened on the Jacobean stage? Would they have kissed in those ways? I mean, you know much better than I about the worries, the concerns that people had writing at the time. About the fact that will be corrupted, these men who watch these boys will be corrupted, and they'll engage in all sorts of practices. Is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
The experience that we had was relaxed and playful, and people were able to cope with it and go away. But how did people see them in the audiences that we had?
Yeah.
It was absolutely clear to some members of the audience, because they told me, that the erotic power of adolescent boys, whether they're dressed as boys or girls, came across in the performance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where does that go? What happens there? Is that just flying around the room
we put it up on? Is the theatre, is the early modern theatre, is the Jacobean theatre, one of those places where culture learns to do sex?
Yeah.
And learns to do sex well? Maybe learns to do sex very badly, learns to do sex disastrously, learns to do sex at a very, very high emotional and human cost.
Yeah.
But this project isn't over, is it?
No.
We're going further. We're continuing in the next stage next year, choosing perhaps another play, which is going to be your baby, that you will once again put together a group of young men who are willing to get on board, to take the risk, to trust, to bash the words, to put on the clothes, to think across, and to continue this looking at the early modern text as something that they want to play with. So we look forward to this, and I wanted to thank you very, very much for having this conversation with me today.
Thank you for thanking me, Carol, but thank you very much. And the interesting thing about that is that all of those boys want to be involved again. And when we're talking about a company, how does a company work? Won't that be interesting if someone who was 12 last year is now 13 and can talk to other 12 or 11 year olds and explain a few things? I think that'd be extremely interesting. So we watch this
and we will
space.
Also each of us be that much older and more mature.
Yes.
Thank you very much.